Thank you very much for that warm welcome, but I fear I must share the warm welcome with our speaker this evening, this afternoon. I've never received such applause at the London School of Economics, so I should stop now, I think. Many of you here are staff and students from the European Institute. Some of you are colleagues from across the school. And as you can see, we are pleased to welcome a number of journalists from different countries here as well. You're all very welcome at the beginning of our LSE school year. And we're delighted to be welcoming back Martin Schulz, President of the European Parliament. Welcome back, because he was speaking here last February. So we're delighted that he's made time in his busy schedule in London to come and speak to us here at the start of our new program. Martin Schulz is a leading member of the German SPD party. He has been a member of the European Parliament for 22 years, and he is the first person ever to serve two terms as president of the European Parliament. We look forward to hearing his comments and his thoughts about the challenges facing Europe, and in particular, the implications of Brexit. Martin has very kindly agreed to limit his comments by way of introduction so that we can have more time for questions and answers with you. So I'll leave my introduction short, and now please welcome our speaker this afternoon, Martin Schulz.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, dear students. It is a great honor to be invited here once again at your prestigious university. Last time I was here on 5th February of this year, and I argued that we needed the United Kingdom to make the EU stronger and better. I painted a picture of a world in 2050 in which no single EU member state was in the G7 and where Europeans made up just 5.4% of the world population. I pleaded for a smart coexistence between the regional, the national, and the European levels, not the triumphant return of the nation state as a solution for all problems. Who would have anticipated precisely what came next? That the campaign here in your country would get so nasty that a member of the United Kingdom Parliament, Joe Cox, would be brutally murdered in broad daylight for her political convictions. As Gordon Brown put it when he visited Brussels ahead of the referendum, how could the most internationally minded of all countries, a model for many other member states, simply walk away from its nearest neighbors after 45 years? Why leave when you could instead lead? And yet, 7 months since my last visit here, we are now trying to figure out how the United Kingdom, as a third country, could best coexist and cooperate with the European Union of 27. Let me first share with you a few personal reflections on this result. The referendum campaign divided British society like no other event I can think of. Let me express the hope that Prime Minister May will continue, as she started in her very first statement, to attempt to reunite British society around an inclusive project and not further feed those divisions. I think The Brexit vote was a loud and clear warning signal for the EU as a whole to reform, and by this I mean not only the EU institutions, but also the member states that make up the European Union. But at the same time, I am very wary of the many vested interests now peddling so-called lessons to be drawn from the referendum. It was not a vote to end the European Union. In fact, a recent survey shows that people maintain trust in the European Union, often more than in their national governments, and want an increased role for the EU in a number of areas. The fundamental point was already captured perfectly by Winston Churchill 70 years ago in Zurich. If the EU gets a competence in a given area, it should also be given the necessary tools to achieve results. This is not about intergovernmentalism versus federalism. The EU is in neither category. It is about delivering effective policy and ensuring that citizens feel their voice counts. However noble the objective, the enterprise is meaningless if the means are not given to achieve it. In many EU policies, we are stuck in this dilemma. It is clear to me that social inequality, stagnating wages, and the middle class, which felt threatened, were the decisive factors in the result. The rural-urban divide was palpable. Free movement of persons was also plainly a factor. And I regret that the benefits of access to the single market were often drowned out in the debate. But to claim now that the vote is a clear popular mandate to sacrifice single market access to the altar of migration is simply wrong. The European Union cannot win the trust of its citizens by repeating the idealistic vision of globalization which has held sway for the last decades. Globalization is increasingly being seen not as opening up a world of opportunities, but as causing a race to the bottom and eroding our core values. It is now perceived by many as a threat to jobs, state finances, and social systems. We should carefully listen to the messages electorates are sending to politicians across Europe and beyond, and refrain from too easily labeling the success of anti-system parties as populist feats. Ladies and gentlemen, dear students, we need to guarantee protection to EU citizens as a strong block, a shield, and not as a Trojan horse. We can only achieve this by being united. And I want to give you just one example. The European Commission's decision in the Apple case a few days ago. Big corporations are playing divide and rule with national governments, confronting them with the threat of relocating to the lowest bidder in terms of fiscal rules and oversight. Only through joint and firm action can we prevent such abusive practices. The institution which I have the honor of presiding since 2012, the European Parliament, will play a key role in setting a new relationship between the European Union and the United Kingdom. Not least because we must consent to any withdrawal treaty and subsequent treaty setting out the full relationship. And everyone wants to avoid the experience we had a few years ago which some of you may remember as the so-called TFTP, Swift Agreement, and the ACTA Agreement, these cases where the European Parliament's priorities were not reflected in the negotiations, and it decided to veto the final deal. I must underline as a preliminary remark that the EU institutions are abiding by the principle no negotiation before notification. This may seem irritating, but it is in fact common sense. It was the United Kingdom's decision to have a referendum. The European Parliament fully respects the result of this referendum, but it is not up to the EU institutions to draw conclusions about what the United Kingdom should do. We first need the UK to tell its partners formally what future it sees with them. Once this happens, the EU27 can decide what they make of such demands. And by the way, the UK needs a united, not a divided EU to achieve a good Brexit deal. A disunited European Union stance on Brexit could mean that there is no agreement between the EU and Britain, and that would be the worst outcome. Therefore, I urge both sides to define a coherent line and not to play one country against another, hoping that via split within the European Union, you could get a better result. It is understandable that such a complex task as the triggering of Article 50 is not a mere formality and requires detailed preparations, which could only start after the referendum result. However, it is also conceivable that the longer the United Kingdom waits to take this step, the more entrenched the respective positions risk becoming. That is why I called on Prime Minister May to notify the UK's departure from the EU as soon as possible. No one can credibly accuse the EU institutions of not having respected the sovereignty of the United Kingdom. Those institutions held back and did not intervene in the run-up to the referendum, despite some of the outright lies and accusations being proffered. What we can't afford to do now is to press the pause button on EU activity when it is in the midst of a migration and a refugee crisis, when it must plan its financial framework for the coming years, when it must complete the economic and monetary union. Moreover, if Article 50 is triggered too late, we run the risk of facing European elections in the United Kingdom in 2019 at the very same time as it is leaving the EU. That would be a very difficult thing to explain to UK and to European citizens. I would like to underline today, with the hindsight of the meetings I have had here in the last 2 days with the Prime Minister and today with the Leader of the Opposition, what I think should be the broad parameters in the future relationship between UK and EU. Firstly, I'm convinced that all actors around the table want to make the best of this unfortunate hand of cards. But let me say this again clearly. The best possible deal, ladies and gentlemen, with the EU is membership of the EU. Any other arrangement necessarily entails trade-offs. Perhaps it is easier to convey what I'm trying to say in culinary terms. There will be no à la carte. Secondly, on free movement, I see a clear majority in the European Parliament for insisting that the fundamental freedoms are inseparable, and especially no freedom of movement for goods, capitals, and services without free movement of persons. I refuse to imagine a Europe where lorries and hedge funds are free to cross borders, but citizens cannot. I cannot accept any hierarchy between these four freedoms. The Union is a community with a shared destiny, a model of society, and not an accountant's club. A number of countries are correct to raise the issue of those citizens who have already exercised their free movement rights and find themselves unwittingly caught up together with their families in the middle of this Brexit, and this cuts both ways. Many Brits living abroad are also affected. I was astonished, honestly astonished, during the campaign to discover that a Pole, an Italian, or a French citizen working in the United Kingdom was an immigrant, whereas a British citizen working in Amsterdam or in Frankfurt or retiring in Spain was an expat. Ladies and gentlemen, this rhetoric is damaging, and it is also dangerous. Many people are looking on with concern at the rise in xenophobic violence and hate crime over here. Somehow, legitimized in the minds of the aggressors by the popular vote. The only correct attitude towards such violence is zero tolerance, and this is the signal expected from the authorities in all member states. Thirdly, we need a setup where the United Kingdom and the European Union can continue to project their core values on human rights, democracy, and the rule of law towards other continental blocs. On foreign policy, we must stay close partners. Fourthly, in the fields of security and defense policy, although the EU loses a key member state, paradoxically, such a separation could give a necessary impulse for a closer integration of the remaining member states. The Franco-German proposal from this summer on security and the proposal from September on defense, largely endorsed last week in Bratislava, are a clear sign of things to come. And there are many ways in which the United Kingdom could engage and contribute to such a new, more coordinated EU of 27 without standing in the way of such integration. I'm not sure how seriously to understand the threats of UK vetoes in this area that have been recently made. Since we are indeed going to reset our relationship, I would make a plea to put an end to this systematic talk of blocking, which is counterproductive and anyway not possible in this case. Fifthly, on trade, perhaps the single most important issue in the upcoming negotiations. I think many tend to underestimate the complexity and delay involved in the UK setting up its own trading relationship with the EU and the world. One just needs to consider that the free trade agreement between the EU and Canada, not known as our most complicated partner, is in the making since 2007. One thing is clear. The EU wants to remain open to the world. The United Kingdom helped to deepen and strengthen the EU single market and open it to other trading partners in the world. It was the United Kingdom that decided to leave a union that it had helped to shape, not the other way around. Many commentators state that the EU without Britain will be a less liberal place. I disagree. I think the real question has to be put to British politicians and to the British public. Will Britain outside the EU remain the outward-looking nation which so many of us know? Ladies and gentlemen and dear students, contrary to how it is sometimes portrayed, the European Parliament is not out on some punitive mission, and I would like to set the record straight on this. The institution I preside is tackling Brexit in a level-headed and fair manner without the slightest hint of retaliation. Last week, the new UK member of the European Commission, Sir Julian King, was voted through in the European Parliament with a real large majority to get on with the business of ensuring our citizens' security. The week before, the Parliament set up its negotiation structure coordinated by Guy Verhofstadt, an experienced statesman, 9 years Prime Minister of Belgium, who has played a key role in the so-called February settlement. Our common challenge is to make the best of this situation, to part ways, but to stay close, working together on the numerous common challenges we have. Let's be honest, despite all the noise coming from commentators whose job is to ramp up the drama, it is not a zero-sum game. A bad deal for the UK will hurt the EU and vice versa. Dear students, for me, as a post-war German, the son of parents who have lived through the horrible experiences that was World War II, the EU, as a guarantor of peace, has always been a fundamental concern. We managed as a community to consign our demons to the past, to unite East and West, to set high social and environmental standards, but those achievements are by no means irreversible. I strongly believe that the European Union is relevant in addressing the challenges of the 21st century. But it must find a new narrative. We cannot shape a new European future at such a time of fragility by indulging in nostalgia. None of us, including the UK, can bring back the past. Rather, we must fight to preserve our way of life and core values. And this can happen only if you, your generation, bright young students such as yourselves, take it into your hands. If you are ready to fight against prejudice, against small-mindedness, against the resurgence of nationalism, populism, and hatred, to promote dialogue, understanding, and uphold our social model built by previous generations. Built by previous generations who had another life than I had and you have. Allow me to conclude with my personal example. My parents lived another life than I lived. My father was born in 1912. He was a child in the First World War and a soldier in the Second World War. My mother was born in 1920, and when my father got back as a prisoner of war from the United Kingdom to Germany, he found his wife with my elder brother, he never had seen before, in a cellar. And the house they had built together was destroyed. I was born in 1955. I belong to the first German generation, which can say that from the date of birth until the death, they have not faced war. Because I'm convinced that the worst day of European integration is better than the best day of a nationalistic Europe. And because I'm convinced that the life of European integration was better than that race, nation against nation, in war and destruction, I strongly believe that we need all the energy, ideas, visions, and pragmatism of your generation to breathe new life into the European project and shape the future of our European Union. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for that very much indeed. We don't have so much time, so we can do the applause at the end of the of the event, perhaps. I'm going to open to questions in a moment, but I wonder if I could just query something with Martin Schulz. At the United Nations yesterday, the British Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, it's an LSE audience, said that those who argue that Britain has to make a choice with Brexit between full access to the single European market and the control of immigration are, quote, talking baloney. In other words, they're stupid. Why is he wrong?
It's difficult to interpret Mr. Johnson's observation. Also during the campaign, it was from time to time really difficult to digest what he said. But I'm full of respect for the foreign minister of the United Kingdom, especially when he is in New York representing the country to the General Assembly. I think, look, the answer was in my eyes given by Prime Minister May by appointing Mr. Davis as responsible for the negotiation with the European Union.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that suitably enigmatic answer. The audience will read in what it wishes to that answer. You're here in London, you've met the Prime Minister, you've met different members of the government, etc. You met them before the referendum, and you've met them again. How far do you think advanced the British government is now in trying to define exactly what it wants from Brexit? On a scale of 1 to 10, What progress has the British government made, do you think, since the referendum, in defining what it wants from Brexit, on a scale of 1 to 10?
Professor, you are putting questions to me. Listen, I was immediately after the result arguing they have to trigger Article 15 now, in 2 days' time, because I felt we have no time to lose. And I must admit that was a spontaneous but not a right reaction. And I recognize that this was not the most rational observation I made in my life, because it is absolutely clear and became for me every day a little bit clearer that the complexity of the whole exercise is enormous. And what we saw was the government here in London expected a majority for stay in. And they were in my feeling, in no way prepared for the leave majority. And therefore they needed a certain time to identify two things: how to leave the European Union from a procedural point of view, and secondly, what will happen after the leave procedure is concluded. I said in my speech, we are speaking already now about the United Kingdom, still a full member of the European Union, as a future third country. Sounds in my ears terrible. The United Kingdom as a third country. But that's the reality. But the relationship between the European Union and third countries are already, I said it with the example with the Canada agreement, very difficult to develop. But now we have, first of all, to find a way how to leave, and then to define in the future the relationship of the third country, which just had left.
Okay, and you're leaving London better informed as
to... No, this is in my eyes what the government here recognized like I did. And,
it's complicated.
But my advantage is I have not to prepare this negotiation, so it is extremely difficult. Nevertheless, we should not really wait too long, because the uncertainty for the economy, for the citizens, and for both sides. City of London is one of the most, or the most important financial place in Europe. Speak to the people here in the City of London. I spoke yesterday with the Mayor of London. Speak to people, to enterprises who are reluctant to invest in the country because they don't know in which legal frame they will operate in future times. This is not yet visible now, but the effect of such reluctance, of such delays, will become visible during the next year, and therefore I urge the government to trigger Article 50 as soon as possible.
Okay, thanks. Now let's open to the audience. We've got audience upstairs and downstairs. There are colleagues with microphones, so could I please just ask you to identify who you are and then ask your question. There will be other occasions, perhaps, in your life to make speeches. Today is not one of them, okay? Could we... is there someone on this side with a microphone? Yes. Could we take the gentleman here? Yes. I'm sorry, yes.
Hello, thank you. I'm Arnold Eisenschmidt. I'm a student of Political Economy of Europe. And my question would be about the general direction of the EU post-Brexit, with one of the key member states leaving. Do you think it would be politically desirable for the EU to proceed with enlargement in the Balkans, especially in the medium term? Or do you think it would rather destabilize the EU? So do you think that would be a good step for the EU? Thank you.
The enlargement, destabilizing the European Union.
No. Yeah. After Brexit, does enlargement look more attractive?
This is a very difficult question because it is touching on phenomena we are facing since years. From a rational point of view, we should enlarge the European Union. From a political reality, we can't enlarge the European Union because you need unanimity, and for any enlargement for the time being, I see no unanimity. And this is not only about Turkey, this is also about the Balkan countries, the Western Balkan states. One thing is clear. To cut that perspective for countries like Montenegro or for Serbia or other countries in the region to join one day the European Union, that would be destabilizing in the countries, because a lot of democratization we saw during the recent decades was because of that European perspective to adopt the fundamental rules of the European Union in rule of law, in human rights, in fundamental rights, in constitutional guarantees to individual citizens. And in respecting especially the international standards, made these countries more democratic. So to close that door is counterproductive. On the other hand, the countries are submitting themselves voluntarily under that regime of pre-access strategy, as we call it. And in the same time, we have to tell them, but there is no majority, no unanimity for joining the Union. This is one of our biggest problems. Therefore, your question touches on one of the biggest problems for European politicians. We must keep the door open, but we must be honest also. There is no short-term enlargement.
Thank you. Let's take the... there's a lady here with an orange front. Can you wait for the microphone, please? No one will hear you. Thanks. This is your moment. That's fine. We'll go with the internet. Did you hear the question?
The free internet, free. Are you speaking about free access or about the investment in the high-speed infrastructure? Yeah. This is, in my eyes, thank you very much for the question, because it allows me to raise a point which is, in my eyes, decisive for the coherence of our society in the future. Jean-Claude Juncker, in his speech for the State of the Union, announced this investment in a high-speed infrastructure all over in Europe. What we are facing for the time being in all countries of the European Union is that the urban regions with a very well high-speed internet are attracting investments, well-skilled young people finding a job there, and the rural areas who have not that infrastructure are becoming every day a little bit more disconnected. It's quite clear that's a spiral. You find the necessary instrument for economic development, high-speed internet, in the urban areas. So an enterprise says, I invest there because elsewhere I have not the infrastructure. So the company is going to that place, young people are going to that place. What does it mean? Nobody goes to the rural areas, and the rural areas are remaining other people. And they are disconnected from investments. And that gap between disconnected rural areas and every day a little bit more complex, becoming every day a little bit more complex, urban areas, with a lot of problems, by the way, also, that the economic concentration in urban areas, look here to London, has advantages and a lot of disadvantages, is splitting our society. If I look to results of votes from time to time, also of referendums, you can see a difference between urban areas and the countryside. And the feeling of the countryside not to matter, to be disconnected from these arrogant people in the urban areas with their strange lifestyle is becoming more and more a problem. Therefore, to invest in that infrastructure is a first step to rebalance the chances of rural areas in relation to urban areas.
Thank you. Could we take the lady here at the front in the red, please?
Thank you. I also have a question relating to the State of the Union speech of Mr. Juncker. He mentioned in his speech that he did not want Europe to be the continent of youth unemployment, but at the same time there will be a cut in funding of almost 75% of the youth guarantee. So what do you think of this cut of funding, and what do you think needs to be done in order to fight youth unemployment in Europe?
The negotiations about the multi-annual financial framework of the European Union, we lost that fight for more money for youth, for the fight against youth unemployment. The fabric of our society is threatened if in some of the member states the best educated generation of history of these countries is to be 50% unemployed. And you know, you all know it. You have in all the countries friends and people who went to school with you together, unemployed, or boyfriends or girlfriends or whatever, members of the family. And if we have some member states, rich member states, in which in some regions the grandparents with the pensions have to pay for the grandchildren because the parents are unemployed as well. I understand those people who raised to me the question, you have hundreds of millions to save banks, how much money you have for my children? And if we will not win that fight against youth unemployment, then the European Union is really at risk. Therefore, to answer briefly, this is a fight we have to win. When national governments cut in Brussels the money for it, they should not be surprised that they are acting counterproductively. One thing is nevertheless important. Job creation happens not only by state investments. My proposal was always, if we propose to enterprises who get subsidies from the budget of the European Union, there's a lot of enterprises, that once they hire a young man or a woman, they get a privilege. Then we combine our investments in companies, for example, high-speed internet companies profiting from subsidies of the European Union in rural areas and hiring people should get a privilege on the interest rates for the credits or in taxation, etc. Here we could combine active investment policy from public budgets with employment effects, especially in the fight against youth unemployment.
Okay, good. Thank you. Can we take the lady at the back in the blue, please? If we could just wait. Yes. Can we get a microphone to the lady with the scarf in the center? Thanks.
Hello, I'm Maureen Coffler from Agence France-Presse. You are set to leave in January your post of president, but there's an unknown. When you've been reconduced, you were planning to leave. Are you still planning to leave, or do you want to stay?
Rather like Britain. Do you want to stay or go?
Very interesting question. Look to the questions of the students here and to my speech. I invest from the early morning to the late night in fighting for solutions for our problems we have. About my individual career, I will think a little bit later.
Okay, thank you.
About my individual career, I think then a little bit later when we have solved the problems.
Okay, so can we take the gentleman in the black?
Je peux le dire aussi en français. Sur ma carrière personnelle, on verra après.
Hi, my name is Niko Szablicki. I'm a student and I would like to know your opinion about direct democracy and the elements that the populistic parties shout for and that made Brexit possible at last.
Democracy is a riskful project because democracy requires responsibility. And what we are facing for the time being is that very irresponsible people with the argument this is democracy are winning elections and destroying really fundamental agreements we need within the society to guarantee coherence. What I saw during recent years, for example, in the European Parliament, also in the referendum campaign here or in other campaigns, how people shameless used lies to mislead voters and recognized after they got their result that they have misled the people. This is a kind of cynism I'm surprised of, because I could not expect that in Europe that could happen once again. We had it already in the last century. Therefore, I'm in favor of direct democracy on local level, for example. It's often very useful. But that be international treaties with an impact, a worldwide impact on the individual life of all the affected citizens should submit to campaigns with such misleading tendencies, I have my doubts. Here I find that parliamentary democracy is also legitimated and perhaps from time to time better.
Thank you. Could we take the lady right at the very back? Yeah. I don't think the microphone is on, actually.
There is another one.
There's another one coming, yeah. Okay. So from Brexit, what happens with the British workers at EU institutions?
First of all, thank you very much that you consider people in the European institutions as workers. This is already a progress. Secondly, we do the utmost to guarantee that they can stay in the institutions. I give a guarantee to the civil servants in my institutions that they should stay. That they could stay. We will for sure not have in future times when the United Kingdom has left the European Union new civil servants from UK, but those who are there should not be punished because of the vote here.
Okay. Good, thanks. And could we take the lady here, please, though?
Hi. Hermonda Kaludra from International Relations Students here. I have a question about, because my focus area is Western Balkan, and I would like to know your opinion. Is this conditional policy that EU is implementing in Western Balkan countries, is it effective? Do these countries have progress? Did they achieve progress because of this policy? Thank you.
This is difficult to answer without taking in account that these are different countries and that we have to make a difference between the countries. In some of the countries, I think we made progress. In other countries, I think we have still a lot of problems. And in some countries, we made progress and we are facing a kind of backlash. When I saw, for example, in Macedonia, the agreement of Ohrid in previous times, I thought this is the way for a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious society prepared to live together. Looking to what happens today, I'm worried. So I can't give you an answer with a coherent judgment about the whole region. It is country specific. We made some progress in some countries, in other countries not efficiently. the conditionality to link cooperation and investment to the fulfillment of criteria is the normal way the European Union is acting. We are acting, for example, in the same way for the time being with Turkey. We are asking Turkey to reform the anti-terror law as a precondition for visa liberalization. And as long as Turkey is not fulfilling that criteria, we can't grant visa liberalization to Turkey. So from a principal point of view, that strategy of conditionality is the right one, I think. But it is for sure not possible to say this is always immediately and entirely effective.
Thank you. Could we take the gentleman down? Could we take the gentleman here at the, on the back row? Could we get a microphone?
Thank you. Owen Bennett from Huffington Post. I just wonder, Mr. Schulz, how much responsibility do you take personally for the Brexit vote? And do you think that it was a lack of movement on reforming freedom of movement which caused the vote to leave on June the 23rd?
Once more, repeat it.
What personal responsibility might you take for the Brexit
vote? My personal responsibility. Indeed. And I understood the second part was.
And the second part is, do you think that it was because of a lack of movement on freedom of movement from the European Union that caused the Brexit vote on June the 23rd?
So my personal responsibility is that I perhaps did not sufficiently interfere here and fight to win perhaps one or another. But I see no individual personal responsibility for the result of a vote in a country 45 years wavering. If it should be a full-fledged member or a half member or a member with a lot of exceptions and never clarified what it wanted to be at the end. Now, at the end, there was a conclusion via a vote in a referendum. I feel no personal responsibility for this undecided development during the last 45 years. I feel an individual responsibility for the so-called agreement we drafted. I was involved in that negotiation. I had a long list of meetings with David Cameron about it because the European Parliament had at the end to ratify and to legislate in that agreement, especially the exceptions the United Kingdom wanted from migrants coming to the United Kingdom and not having access to welfare system in a certain delay. Therefore, I have a personal responsibility for that agreement. That agreement was concluded in February. I promised as President of the European Parliament to fight for it, for a majority in the Parliament. Not easy, because my own parliamentarian group was very reluctant for discrimination of workers in Europe. And that agreement was refused in the United Kingdom, not in the European Union. And therefore I have no personal responsibility. I hope so.
Good, thanks. Could we take the lady here, please? Sorry, here. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Hi, I'm Rachel Venables from LBC here in London. I know in the last 24 hours you met with Theresa May, with Sadiq Khan and with Jeremy Corbyn. You mentioned that briefly earlier, but could you just run us through what you spoke to with each, what you spoke about with each of the three of them and whether they had anything to say on Brexit that you liked?
With Theresa May? I met for the first time and we spoke about the state of play of preparation of the government of the United Kingdom for the Brexit negotiations. And the result was that we have to wait. And I expressed my hope that perhaps on the party congress of the Conservative Party next week and we have a little bit more light at the end of the tunnel. With the mayor of London, I spoke exactly about that. And he asked me, what did Theresa May say? And I told him exactly. And with Jeremy Corbyn in the morning, he asked me, what said the mayor of London and Theresa May? It was exactly what I said.
Okay. But I understood before that in the response to the questioner asked at the beginning, I understood that you're not leaving London tremendously better informed as to what the British government might be seeking from Brexit.
Honestly, I leave London with that feeling that the government is undecided how and when they should trigger Article 50, but also with the feeling that they perceive more and more that the European side, the 27 and the institutions in Brussels and Strasbourg, can't wait too long. I want to repeat once more what I said during my speech. I discussed this also with all three interlocutors, with the mayor, with the opposition leader, and with the prime minister. There was yesterday in the debate an argument, in April next year, we have the election in France. And then in September, we have the general election in Germany. And to draw the whole debate about Brexit into the election campaign in these two countries, is it not too dangerous? And I said, don't forget the general election in the Netherlands. This is in March. And this is the country where also a vibrant debate is on the road if they should not leave the European Union. We have every day, everywhere in the European Union, an election. In December, we have perhaps once more election in Spain. So if the election calendar of the member states is the reason to be carefully in triggering Article 50, we are lost. But if we delay it because we say, but the decisive election, that's Germany and France, to September next year, then we trigger Article 50 in October 2017. And then we start a period of 2 years' time, and then we have in summer 2019 to vote candidates here in the United Kingdom for the European Parliament, as members of the European Parliament, and some months later, the 2 years period is over and they have to leave from the European Parliament. This is a so-called short-term membership of the European Parliament. I think this is and raise once more an enormous list of questions, pensions and transitional salaries. So I prefer to trigger Article 50 earlier.
Good, thanks. Could we take the gentleman in the very center, please? Yeah. Sorry, could you put your hand up again? Yeah.
Thank you for your speech. I'm Salvatore. I'm a student at the European Institute. My question regards the modality of the Brexit negotiations once the Article 50 would have been triggered by the UK. So the head of the European Council had appointed Didier Sous as a special negotiator for Brexit, same with Jean-Claude Juncker, who appointed Michel Barnier, and you recently appointed Guy Verhofstadt for the same task. How can we expect the European Union to act and to as a coherent partner in the negotiation and to propose a concise and coherent positions, while in the United Kingdom they will only have one person on the side, which is David Davis, the Brexit Secretary, though I respect the independence of all of the European institutions and what will be their working relations. Thank you.
Very interesting question, showing that there is really a risk I tried to address in my speech. The United Kingdom government, I share entirely the spirit of your question. The United Kingdom has an advantage. The advantage is they are waiting. And they are defining here in London their position. And once they have a position, this is the single British negotiation position. And there is the risk that that coherent British position meets a very incoherent European position. Some here may hope that this is our advantage, then we are splitting them. And we get what we want. But a disunited European Union at the end will not agree. And then we have no deal. And this is a disadvantage for both sides. Therefore, how to guarantee on the European side a maximum of coherence. And therefore, you should look to the procedure, and then it is easier to explain why we appointed different person. First of all, the council, that means the member states, have to define a mandate for the negotiations. And this is drafted in the council by a coordinator appointed in the council. Mr. Zeus is the man. And once that guidelines are adopted, the commission has to start to transform these guidelines in concrete plans for negotiation. This is the task of Mr. Barnier. And once the agreement is negotiated, you have a vote in the parliament, because this is an international legally binding treaty between the union and the leaving country. And that has to be ratified in the European Parliament. And to assure that the parliament is from the first day involved in the whole process, to avoid a surprise at the end, that a not involved parliament votes no, for example, so that we can, in close cooperation, guarantee a maximum of coherence, member states and institutions, we appointed a coordinator of the parliament, Guy Verhofstadt. By the way, Mr. Zeus, who is the coordinator in the council, was a long time when Mr. Verhofstadt was the prime minister of Belgium, the spokesman of Mr. Verhofstadt as prime minister. So they know each other, and Michel Barnier is a long-serving member of the parliament, of the French government, and of the commission. He knows all the institutions. They are. They will be in a very close relationship, I think, every day.
Good, thank you. Can we take the gentleman here in the white shirt, please?
Hello, Lukas Werner, IPE student here at LSE. Mr. Scholz, I would like to know how the European Union and the European Social Democratic Parties can face the challenges of nationalism and populism in Europe.
How much time we have to... First of all, not to copy the populists. There is an attempt, often also on the left wing, to simplify. In an everyday, more complex world, to give simple answers. This is not the left way. My advice is nevertheless simple. I try to tell to my colleagues in my own party, you are German, as I presume, in my own party, but also in other countries, to take very serious that hardworking people playing by the rules feel often not respected. And that the vote for right-wing extremists is often not, even not a vote of people who are socially or economically disconnected. These are people who are working hard, couples, from the early morning to the late night working and not able to pay the fee for the apartment, the rent for the apartment. Or to have the money for holidays, or for something for the children. And we, as politicians, what are we doing on a national and European level? We are discussing about billions, every day about billions. A billion here, 10 billion there, 20 billion yesterday, 50 billion tomorrow. For most of the people here, I think a million is an enormous amount of money. I don't know for you, but for me, for sure. So, but for 99% of our voters, 1,000 euros or pounds is an enormous amount of money. And they have the feeling, my 1,000 euros don't care. They don't care about my 1,000 euros. My 1,000 euros doesn't matter. If they feel that our discussion about the billions is to save that they with 1,000 euros can survive, for example, by fighting against tax evasion, that the owner of a pub here pays the taxes to the city of London and an American coffee company beside don't pay a single pound, but makes billions of profits. This is a feeling of injustice, therefore the fight against tax evasion. To discuss not only as a social democrat about the spending side of a budget, to speak also about the spending side, but also about the revenue side, and to tell to citizens that we can't get the taxes in a globalized economy only on a national level, that we need a transnational system via introduction of the principle the country of the profit is the country of the tax. This is easy to understand and gives people the feeling they care with their billions about my 1,000 euros. If we as left-wing parties will convince citizens that this is our goal, then they will allow us to discuss about billions. But we must give them back that feeling that we are protecting their interests, their individual interests. Once more, Bill Clinton said once in his election campaign in the early 90s, people working hard and playing by the rules, these are my voters. We must be the protecting force for people working hard and playing by the rules in Europe. Then we will get back trust.
Thank you. I think we're coming to the last question. Could we take the gentleman in the center in the white shirt, please? Perhaps they could pass the microphone along. You okay for...
Yeah. How much I don't know how much when time I have. Yeah, how much? Wie viel Zeit habe ich noch?
Yep.
Huh?
It's
10 minutes?
It's 2:30. It's 2:40
at the moment. 2:40.
Go ahead.
So 5 minutes.
Yep. Sure. Thank you very much. I'll try and
this
make it quick.
This is 3 questions. If I give short answers.
Cameron Karami. I'm a student here at the European Institute. Sometimes people can get the feeling that this feels like. Brexit feels like kind of a black swan event, an anomaly, shall we say. And people sort of joke about it and they say, okay, let's get on with finishing it and getting it out of the way. My question to you is, do you feel like you're taking any lessons from this? Do you feel like you're actually changing your strategies for the future of Europe? It seems like that hasn't been the case, that it's something to laugh about and try and get out of the way quickly. Do you actually think this is changing Europe in any way? Thank you.
That question is raised to me permanently. I was the common candidate of Social Democratic parties for the European election in 2014. And the main message of my election campaign was Brussels should not do everything. I'm in favor of redelegating competences on a regional, national and local level, reducing the scope of responsibilities in Brussels. Whatever you can do near to citizens, do it there. This is the experience I made as a mayor of a 40,000 inhabitant city during 11 years. So I'm fighting since years and years and years for reforming the European Union. And a lot of those proposals who were made were blocked by one country. So, but then you understand perhaps that I'm surprised that in that country, after that result, people say, yeah, you didn't change. The European Union is not me, Juncker or Tusk. The European Union is as strong or weak as the member states allow it. It's not the European Union who has founded the Federal Republic of Germany or invented France or created Italy. It is the other way around. The member states built that union. And as long as the member states share that responsibility, success in Brussels made by the 28 heads of state and government is national. I convinced my colleagues, j'ai convaincu les collègues de suivre la France, ich habe die Leute überzeugt, dass der deutsche Vorschlag der richtige war. This is the sound in case of success. In case of failure, it is, yeah, you know this Brussels bubble. So, this is not my responsibility. I'm fighting against this. Nevertheless, it is a failure. A G7 country, the second economy of the European single market, a permanent veto power of the Security Council, leaving the European Union is a disaster for us and for the United Kingdom. Because if the United Kingdom is a G7 country and the second economy, because it has the full and unrestricted access to the biggest single market in the world, and via that market and the trade agreements to other markets of the world. That was cut now here. Therefore, it is a lose-lose situation for the time being, and logically, we have to take the necessary consequences that should not be repeated in other countries. And this has a lot to do, not only with institutional questions, also with the fact, and this is perhaps in relation to the previous question, that we are the richest part of the world with a very poor and unfair distribution of wealth. If we will not change this, and that was also a reason for the vote here, then the European Union is really at risk.
Okay, thank you for your questions and your attention, but please join me in giving very warm thanks to Martin Schulz, President of the European Parliament. Thank you very much. You'll have seen, perhaps from the LSE website, that we have a series of lectures for the European Institute. And this year, for the first time, of course, we'll be having a distinct series of lectures on Brexit. So do look for those events coming up. Can I now please ask you to remain in your seats, including our colleagues from the press? Could you please remain where you are whilst the President vacates the theatre? Thank you very much.